We'll proceed to the fourth case of the day, Massey v. Baker O'Neill Holding. Mr. Lips.
May it please the court, my name is Jeff Lips and I represent the...
You should not take it amiss that when you arrived the courtroom was full and the very last people are leaving. It's not an advance comment on this argument, I hope.
Well, I will say I'm from Ohio, so maybe they're making a commentary about that as well. Your Honor, we're here on this case on an appeal from the district court de novo review of a summary judgment finding on a fraudulent conveyance claim under Michigan law. The parties do not contest that Michigan law is what determines this particular appeal. I would submit, for your Honor's consideration, that the district court, in its decision, started off by acknowledging that this was a complicated set of facts and that there were a number of disputed issues that were presented in the record below. At that point, I believe the court just veered off in a number of erroneous paths by applying the wrong law, improperly resolving factual disputes that would be left more appropriately to the trier fact, and failed to give appropriate inferences to the defendant on a summary judgment consideration. The initial error that was made by the court, the district court in particular, was a failure to apply the right standard when looking at the agreement to agree. That was a dispositive issue in the court's mind. The court concluded, essentially, as a matter of law, that the agreement to agree was, in fact, unenforceable and that was outcome determinative for the rest of the fraudulent conveyance situation. We have cited in our brief the Updike case, which is the Michigan Supreme Court ruling with respect to what the parties are entitled to on an agreement to agree where there is a challenge as to whether it's a definite or an indefinite agreement. And the Supreme Court was quite clear in the Updike case that that is a question of fact and that is to be determined by the trier fact. In this instance, the court took that agreement to agree out of the hands of the trier of fact, made a determination, and then proceeded to apply it as an outcome determinative.
When you say out of the hands of the trier of fact, out of whose hands is it being taken? And there won't be a jury trial in this case. The bankruptcy judge is the trier of fact. So one, the problem would be that it's being taken out of what, the bankruptcy judge's own future hands, and that would be true only if there's more evidence the bankruptcy judge would be hearing later than the bankruptcy judge had now. What's the more evidence?
The more evidence, Your Honor, is the right to put witnesses on the stand and cross-examine them and for it to be played out in the front of, and in the context of a particular case. That is an important right that we have with respect to trials themselves. This was not an agreed-upon paper trial, but that's essentially what the bankruptcy judge converted it to.
That's certainly how the bankruptcy judge treated it. And I'm were you clear before the bankruptcy judge that you thought there were things that needed some kind of credibility test by putting witnesses on the stand and seeing if they began to roll three steel balls in their hand or some other important credibility issue?
Well, by virtue of opposing the summary judgment, submitting our affirmative proof that would support a contested factual issue, yes, we were very clear to the court that we wanted to have the trial. We were also very clear that we would and never agreed to any paper ruling at this point. I understand that the trier fact would be the bankruptcy court, assuming that this is determined to be a core proceeding. And that is an issue that was presented at the before the bankruptcy judge itself, and it is also
an
issue.
It would be the bankruptcy judge, even if it were an adversary proceeding. There's no jury trial in this kind of thing treated as an adversary proceeding.
No, but the district court retains the right to not...
The district judge could withdraw the reference. Did you ask the judge to withdraw the reference?
At the time in the lower court, no, we did not, because we did not believe we were going to trial before the bankruptcy judge. But we did at the lower court or at the bankruptcy court stage, we did object to the conclusion that it was a core proceeding. We don't think the unjust enrichment, for example, is a core proceeding. That's clearly, in our judgment, a non-core proceeding. And we have cited in our brief and cited to the district court the fact that where you have a fraudulent conveyance that's determined under state law, that that is not necessarily a court proceeding. Clearly, fraudulent conveyances under bankruptcy law and the like are court proceedings, but I think it's an open issue as to whether or not that's a court proceeding or not. So I would submit, Your Honor, that there's two aspects to responding to your question. One is that we do have the right to the interplay of what happens on the stand with rules of evidence applying and the witnesses testifying, and I also think it's not a foregone conclusion that the bankruptcy judge would, in fact, be the ultimate trier of fact on these issues should it go back for a trial.
I got another question about what's in the record. You referred to this document as an agreement to agree. Was there any effort made to understand it or perhaps value it on a different basis, that is, as an option for a period of time to purchase the Massey business?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that the parties understood and that the evidence that was in the record was that this was the agreement to agree on the sale, and then there would be a definitive agreement that would follow, and the parties were working through the various due diligence and providing financial information. But I don't believe there's been anything in the record that would be submitted, to my knowledge, that would suggest this was being defended or argued as an option. Mr. Massey had clearly sat down with the other party, and they reached an agreement on a particular transaction. The parties then proceeded to execute on it, and the plaintiffs in this particular instance did understand that they had an agreement. They proceeded to take steps to finalize that particular agreement, including going out in the marketplace of their investor pool and future investors, and were successful in securing additional funds following the execution of this agreement, and they were also successful in obtaining extensions that otherwise would not have been obtained. So the bottom line point that I'm trying to make on the fraudulent conveyance claim is that Michigan law does say that on an agreement to agree, that is a fact issue that should go to the trier of fact to determine whether or not the parties have agreed to an agreement and what the terms are of it. Secondly, once you reach that conclusion, if you take the district court's conclusion that the agreement is unenforceable, that's not an outcome determinative factor. Michigan law is very clear that they have struggled with their statute in trying to add some definition to the fair consideration criterion. What they've come up with is a totality of circumstances test, which is a five-part test. The district court did not apply that test properly. For example, they, as we stated in our brief, he ignored the execution proof point. He tried to treat that as synonymous with insolvency, and the cases are very clear that that is not synonymous. An execution proof in the seminal case focused on the passage of time and the question whether there's any evidence that there was an attempt to put assets outside of the control of creditors, and that was not the case here, that there's no evidence whatsoever that suggested that, and there was a 16-month time period that passed between the transaction and when the ultimate bankruptcy occurred. And one important factor to weigh in as you evaluate, which the trier of fact should have done and did not in this particular case, is the bad acts and the unclean hands that were occurring during this 16-month period. Even the bankruptcy court acknowledges, as we set forth in the brief, that there was a 5.06, I think, judgment that was entered against one of the officers of this particular company as a result of his misappropriation of assets. He was buying cars, he was buying houses, and from an execution proof standpoint, I would submit that clearly the inference that we're entitled to on a summary judgment is that these misappropriation acts that led to a judgment that were occurring at the very time time was passing and the parties were trying to reach an agreement would lead one to the conclusion that that was the contributing factor as opposed to this transaction itself rendering the company execution proof. A couple other factors is the value point, I think, is very significant. This court, in many instances, the district court, in many instances, throughout its opinion says no consideration is not fair consideration, and he only got to the conclusion that it was no consideration by concluding the agreement was unenforceable, and therefore it trumped, was the word he used. It trumped every other consideration. We are entitled to have the evidence come in that would demonstrate that the totality of the circumstances show that there was fair consideration, fair value under all the criteria provided to the plaintiff in this particular transaction for the $2.5 million deposit. And we've cited some cases that say the value is not strictly the passage of property, it's not strictly the release of a particular debt. It can include intangible factors. We've put some of the gambling cases in there. And there is a lot of discussion about the intangible values that would relate to a particular transfer. And that evidence, again, was contested, was put into the record, and should have been weighed as a result of a particular trial rather than a summary disposition.
Mr. Lipps, the Massey Group, is that a legal entity?
The Massey Group itself, as it was used, was not a legal entity.
Nor is the Don Massey Dealership Group a legal entity, right? Now, the reason I ask you that, I just wonder in Opdyke versus Doris whether we had, and I appreciate the command of the Supreme Court and its language there, whether we had that same kind of situation as to the entities, literally the parties that we're talking about.
Yeah, and Your Honor, I would submit that I think the agreement itself, and I don't have it laid out in front of me, but I think the agreement itself was executed by Mr. Massey, who was represented to be the sole shareholder of each of the individual dealership corporations. I think the use of the Massey Group and that type of language in there was simply intended to be an umbrella capture of what would ultimately be those individual corporations.
But isn't it true that Mr. Massey, in some situations, had outright ownership and some he did not?
If you're talking about the Arnold Palmer particular dealerships, yes, he had a minority interest in those, and that was not going to transfer as part of the particular transaction. There are repeated instances that are in the record that we've cited in the brief where Mr. Massey was unequivocal that he was not transferring his interest in Arnold Palmer. There were a couple affidavits that the district court described as being for purposes of defining the Massey Group. I would submit that if you look at the affidavits, you would see they were for other purposes, and that unfortunate use or insertion of Cadillac cannot override or somehow turn it as a matter of law that the assets that we're going to transfer were anything other than those 13 dealerships. The Arthur Anderson financial report shows 13 separate dealerships and separately accounts for those two minority interests. So I would submit that the proper legal entity, Mr. Massey himself, entered into the agreement to agree, and I'm not sure that's an impediment to the application of Opdyke. The reference to the Massey Group was simply a convenient shorthand. And I think you'll note in the agreement itself there was also a line that says the parties understand what assets, or they understand each other's assets. So that's a reflection that the parties knew what was going on. I don't think there's been any evidence presented for Mr. O'Neill where he did not understand that the Arnold Palmer dealerships were not going to transfer.
An extraordinarily loose language for a $300 million deal, isn't it?
It is.
From sophisticated business people.
It is, Your Honor, but you got to understand, as we've shown in the record, there was a prehistory here. There was a history that had preceded this, including another agreement. There was some evidence that came in as a result of the bankruptcy court's cross-examination of one of the witnesses that was put on unclean hands. In which this napkin deal concept is something that is not that uncommon within the automobile industry. And Mr. Massey had been out trying to sell his dealerships for some period of time. But I would agree with you that the lawyers in this room certainly would prefer to see something more precise and something perhaps tight.
Maybe a tablecloth rather than a napkin.
But if you look at the Opdyke case, the Michigan Supreme Court does in fact affirm Corbin's analysis that business people do things in a much more informal sense than what those of us lawyers prefer to do, and there was clearly a contemplation that there would be a definitive agreement and they would go forward. But these two individuals struck a deal. They understood what was being transferred and they understood what the price was going to be, and if there was any ambiguity or subject to interpretation, Opdyke says that should have been put before the trier of fact. I want to briefly address the unjust enrichment claim, but before I do that, let me just quickly address insolvency. Insolvency is a requirement for the fraudulent conveyance statute. The evidence, as best as I can determine, is essentially the classic battle between two particular experts. One has concluded that the company is insolvent. The other has concluded
that it's not. I'm now going to ask you the same question as before. You know, the bankruptcy judge is the trier of fact. Is this a subject on which you think seeing whether the expert's sweat on the stand would help the bankruptcy judge resolve the issue?
I have two answers to that. I say without a doubt, having an expert witness sit up there and be subject to cross-examination and explanation of his or her basis for his or her opinions, and having the bankruptcy court have the right to cross-examine is fundamental in determining the credibility of a particular witness as well as the expert, as well as the opinions.
The reason I ask this is because it's not a question of credibility. Whether something is debt or equity doesn't depend on whether Mr. Sponsel, your expert, believes what he says. It depends on whether what he says is substantively convincing under the governing legal standard.
Well, the governing
standard... Nobody doubted that Sponsel believes everything he says.
Well, I agree with that, but what I would say is that this is an accounting issue, and it is the application of accounting principles, and those are not precise. And those, in many ways, are subject to what your explanation is, as well as what basis you use in reaching a particular conclusion. The fundamental overriding accounting concept that both experts acknowledge is that you've got to look at the economic substance versus
which
the form.
Which, of course, then you probably don't want an accountant at all. Field in which economic substance and the discipline of accounting overlaps is invisibly small.
But before I sit down, I would like to give you the second part of my response to your question, Your Honor, which is I don't believe the bankruptcy court or the district court ever considered Sponsel's opinion. I think they proceeded to throw out his supplemental affidavit, and I think they discredited his underlying opinion in a manner that they never really put the insolvency into the pitched situation that a trial would have.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lips. Mr. Hull?
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Andy Hull. May it please the Court, I'm counsel for American Public Automotive Group and Baker O'Neill Holdings. By this suit, APAG seeks to recover the $2.5 million payment that it made to Don Massey on May 28, 1997. APAG has twice prevailed, both before the bankruptcy court and the district court. APAG obtained summary judgment on its fraudulent conveyance theory, and it obtained a judgment after a trial on the claim of unjust enrichment. The district court's judgment should be affirmed on three grounds. First, APAG should recover the payment as a fraudulent conveyance because the writing is an unenforceable agreement to agree, and APAG received nothing for the payment. Second, APAG should recover the payment as a fraudulent conveyance, even if the writing is an enforceable agreement, because under the writing or the purported transaction, APAG received nothing of value, only the right to grossly overpay for the so-called Massey Group in the future. Third, APAG should recover the payment on the unjust enrichment theory because it is inequitable for Mr. Massey to retain the payment. The district court correctly concluded that the payment was a fraudulent conveyance. A fraudulent conveyance under Michigan law requires three elements, two of which are in issue in this appeal. First, whether the transfer was without fair consideration. Second, whether the debtor was insolvent or the transfer caused the debtor to become insolvent. As I mentioned before, there are two independent grounds, alternative grounds, why APAG did not receive fair consideration for the payment. First, because the writing is an unenforceable agreement to agree. Second, because if it was not, it was only an invitation to grossly overpay for the so-called Massey Group.
Now, I have the same question I asked of your adversary, but I assume I'll get the same answer, but I might as well ask it again. Was any effort made to value this document by treating it as an option?
No. None whatsoever, to my knowledge. The Michigan UFCA, the statute at issue, provides a statutory definition of the requirement for fair consideration. It's in the statute. Fair consideration requires an exchange of property as a fair equivalent, therefore, an exchange of property. The undisputed facts in this case demonstrate that Massey exchanged no property with APAG in return for the $2.5 million payment. Now, there's been a great deal of discussion about the totality of the circumstances test used by Michigan courts to determine whether fair consideration is exchanged in a given case. Predictably, the test includes an inquiry as to what property or value was exchanged by the party with the debtor. Now, in addition, the test includes other factors that might be of assistance to a court in a close case in trying to understand whether fair equivalence was exchanged. The district court correctly concluded in this case that where the absence of property or value conveyed to the debtor is established, that outcome or that controls the outcome of the analysis. Now, the district court did go through and consider all of the various factors that have been articulated by Michigan courts, but it was clear that tying back to the statute, that is the inquiry, was fair equivalence exchanged, and that's the inquiry dictated by the statute. The district court's analysis is consistent with the statute, and it is consistent with the bankruptcy court's reasoning in Webster, where the court reasoned that in some cases it will be clear whether the debtor received fair consideration simply by looking at the value of the property received. Turning to the issue of the writing as an unenforceable agreement to agree, the district court correctly applied principles of Michigan contract law. For a contract to enter into a future contract to be enforceable, it must set forth all the material terms and leave none to future negotiations. To be enforceable, a contract to enter into a future contract must specify all the material and essential terms and leave none to be agreed upon as a result of future negotiations. This writing does not specify all the material and essential terms. In response to that circumstance, on summary judgment, it was incumbent upon Mr. Massey, as the non-movement, to provide probative, objective facts suggesting that there was a meeting of the minds on the material and essential terms of the writing. Massey, in brief and at argument, has made reference to the Updike case. The Updike case is not instructive to Mr. Massey's burden of proving objective, probative evidence of a meeting of the minds. In Updike, the writing contained the essential terms, and the court was only called upon to presume a reasonable time to complete performance and a reasonable time to take possession of the project. The issue in Updike concerns subjective evidence of intent to be bound. That was the issue in Updike. That was the issue upon which the Michigan Supreme Court turned and said, well, we should allow evidence on summary judgment of subjective intent to be bound. That is not an issue in this case. For purposes of summary judgment, there was no suggestion or challenge that the writing doesn't reflect an intent to be bound. The problem with the writing is the writing. It is the internal inconsistencies and the ambiguities. The district court does, I think, a fine job of describing some of the various ambiguities and inconsistencies within the writing. What dealerships were to be sold? The Massey Group is not a legal entity. Massey owns three different groupings of dealerships, if you will. He owns Cadillac dealerships, which he identifies in his repetitive short affidavits, saying, this is the Massey Group, my Cadillac dealerships. Submitted to the bankruptcy court on summary judgment. He then owns dealerships in partnership with Arnold Palmer and Mark McCormick.
I hope you will sometime come to the insolvency question. I think that's the hardest point for you, and it's pretty obvious that the Massey Group doesn't refer to anything intelligible.
I'll be glad to turn to that now, Your Honor. The UFCA provides...
The what?
the Michigan Uniform the Michigan Uniform Fraudulent Conveyance Act.
Fraudulent Conveyance Act. Okay. Yeah, acronyms don't always take.
And I apologize, Your Honor. It provides a definition for the court to for the court to use in determining when a debtor is insolvent.
Right. The big question here is the reclassification of the is whether the debt paper should be reclassified as equity.
Yes.
Right. Now, Sponsel says that none of the investors ever was paid interest. That the firm booked no interest as payable. That the proposed rate of interest was absurd. 8% in a non-operating 8% rate of interest for debt paper in a non-operating corporation is economic lunacy, and that therefore, he says, people have to understand this as equity. The only way in which anybody hoped to make money on this investment was to exercise the right to convert to equity, and therefore this is equity paper. And if indeed it's equity paper, then the firm was solvent. So how does one resolve this kind of claim? Or perhaps more appropriately, how can one resolve this kind of claim on summary judgment?
Your Honor, if I might, I'd like to address that question in two parts.
Mm-hmm.
First, the factual basis within the record for what Sponsel had to say, and second, the issue of his lack of application of principles or methodologies to any ultimate conclusion.
No, the ultimate conclusion will be made by the court. What I was reciting from Sponsel was just his propositions of fact.
Well, his propositions of fact are nowhere supported in the record and, in fact, are contradicted by evidence submitted to the court on summary judgment.
Yeah, well, look, if we've got contradictory evidence in the record, you're just telling me why there needs to be a trial.
There's not contradictory evidence. There are the assertions of Mr. Sponsel, which are contradicted by the evidence submitted on the record. Mr. Sponsel says that he believes that, for example, investors were not looking for interest; they were looking for an upside return in the conversion of this of the convertible notes to common stock. He says that he never interviewed any accredited investors.
Look, I recited what I thought was important, and what I recited didn't have anything to do with the contents of investors' heads.
Well, Your Honor, I guess what the point that I'm trying to make in answering Your Honor's question is this. There is no objective evidence that I am aware of within the record that supports Mr. Sponsel's factual assertions.
Okay, well, let's go through it step by step. Are you disputing his proposition that none of the investors was ever paid interest?
No.
Are you disputing his proposition that your client never... Well, not your client anymore, but, you know, that the issuer of this debt paper never booked interest in its statements of accounts.
Yes, and that was shown to be false.
You think that was true?
Yes.
Are you disputing his proposition that the rate of interest on these instruments was below the prime rate at the time?
No.
And below prime rate instruments, unsecured in something that has no going concern value, look really, really weird, right, just as an economic matter. I don't see how anybody could hope to make money on below prime rate unsecured instruments in something that was not even a going concern. But the only way in which one would think, the only way you could understand that is that objectively the money was to be made by converting to equity, by taking these as the equivalent of stock or maybe even the equivalent of warrants. But that's an objective proposition rather than contents of anybody's head.
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Wilhelm speaks to this issue that the notes are properly, from an accounting perspective, dealt with as convertible debt instruments. There's no question that the notes are legal debt instruments. There's no question that the notes were personally guaranteed by individuals. APB 14, the Accounting Principles Board opinion, makes clear that the correct accounting for debt such as the notes is to record the entire amount as debt. But I would submit to the court that the question is not the accounting treatment for this convertible debt security.
Yeah, I've already said that. It's not an accounting question. It is a legal question.
Yes. And, Your Honor, I guess I do not understand the reason, other than what the court has identified as a below-prime interest rate, I don't understand or don't believe there's anything else in the record that would suggest that the notes are anything other than debt instruments. It remains a debt instrument, Your Honor, notwithstanding the fact that the note holders had bargained for the right at their option to convert the note to the common stock of APAC. That doesn't change the nature of the debt instrument. It doesn't convert it to equity. And there's been no proposition or support that I have seen in briefing or by the expert testimony on that point. The evidence was that APAG did accrue interest on the notes. The evidence was that accredited investors did demand payment of interest on the notes. It was recorded as a liability on APAG's financial statements. It was sought by the accredited investors in their proofs of claim filed in the bankruptcy proceeding. Your Honor, if I might briefly turn to the alternative ground of lack of fair consideration, that being the issue of gross overpayment. The testimony of Mr. Wilson, plaintiff's expert witness, was that completion of the purported transaction would have resulted in a gross overpayment to Mr. Massey in the magnitude of $200 to $300 million. Mr. Massey, in response, really offers two criticisms of that analysis. First, he says the lower court shouldn't looked at the ultimate transaction. Your Honors, I see that I'm out of time.
You may complete the thought.
All right, thank you. And my point, Your Honor, is this, that Mr. Massey's argument that you shouldn't look at the ultimate transaction that you were to enjoy for payment of the $2.5 million, yet, of course, the self-evident truth is that money paid for an opportunity to simply grossly overpay for an asset later on is not itself fair consideration and could not be under the Michigan UFCA. Thank you very much.
Mr. Lipson, I want to see if you have any more time. You had no more time, but I'll allow you a minute for rebuttal.
I doubt that I'll take a minute, Your Honor. Okay. I just wanted to mention briefly one other point, which is on the unjust enrichment claim. My adversary did describe that as a trial. I would submit that if you look at the record, trial was a gross overstatement, to use the language we've heard. I think his proof was about 40 minutes. We've spent more time in this courtroom than actually happened in terms of presentation on it, and the reason is because the court simply dropped down the summary judgment findings, entered that as law of the case, and precluded any further evidence. If the summary judgment findings are in fact error and we should have had trial, then that would pollute or taint the entire unjust enrichment.
Thank you, Mr. Lips. Our thanks to all counsel, and the case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the